This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
One of our classic Zen stories is about the first Chinese Zen ancestor, Bodhidharma, who just sat in his cave all day, resting in the space of boundless awareness. And Huayka, his disciple, who would later be the second ancestor, came to Bodhidharma and said, "My mind is not at peace. Please pacify it for me." We could understand this, "Please pacify it for me," as like, "Please give me a way. Please offer me a way to pacify my mind. I know you can't really just do it, but please pacify my mind for me." And Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind and I'll pacify it for you." And Huayka maybe spent some time standing there looking for it, and eventually said, "When I look for my mind, I can't find it." And Bodhidharma said, "I've pacified it for you." It's a relevant story to this discussion. Bring me your mind. When I look for this mind, and maybe when he looked for this mind, he first looked for the unpacified mind, the mind that's not at peace, which would be like the individual consciousness, the dualistic consciousness. That's the one that's not at peace, right? When I look for that one, this disturbed mind, I can't find it. Maybe if he'd been meditating for a while, he'd see, "When I look for this disturbed mind, all I really find is the awareness of it." That's really all there is to the disturbed mind, is knowing the disturbance. But then when I look for this awareness of the disturbed mind, I can't find that one either, actually. So yesterday we were talking about the small mind as like the individual dualistic consciousness, and big mind as the shared, non-dual awareness. And neither one of them can really be found. And the not finding is the pacification, right? If we can find something, which means grasp something, then that's not peaceful. Not finding, not being able to grasp anything is true peace. Mind cannot be grasped, is the peacefulness of mind. We, sentient beings, are the kind of search for peace and contentment and happiness, I would propose. I would even propose, we could say, that's the definition of a sentient being. It's not so much that we sentient beings do various things like look for happiness, but That's kind of what we are. We have some extra things too, like bodies and consciousness and stuff. But really what we are as sentient beings are, you could say what a sentient being actually is the continuous looking for peace and contentment. We might say, well, I'm looking for it sometimes, but not always. I would say it's like continuous. Maybe not in our deep dreamless sleep, but in our waking life, it seems to me like everything we do is in order to find more contentment. This may be kind of a big statement, and we could consider it, but scratching an itch or something unconsciously is like looking for a little bit more contentment. Having a cup of tea, moving a little bit in zazen, thinking this thought or that thought. It's like what we do. We can't help it once we're born as a sentient being. And basically we're looking for it, this contentment or peace. We're looking for it in experiences, which are, as we've talked about, events that arise and cease in time and space, and they're conditioned, therefore they're impermanent, and it kind of works to some extent. We try in various ways to find this peace and contentment, and we get some of it. Like we have a cup of tea and it quenches our thirst, and we scratch the itch and it's gone. So it kind of works, but the problem is that this peace and contentment is very temporary. It's conditioned and temporary, and as soon as we feel fulfilled or content, we immediately, as a sentient being, feel some other sense of lack or something that we need, and we look for it. And there's nothing wrong with this. I think we can't help it as sentient beings. And I'm doing this all the time too. But I would say that it doesn't have anything to do with my practice. I would probably keep doing it, but it's like, it's just what I do as a sentient being. And then I have my practice that's kind of like also looking for peace and contentment, but it's going in a different direction. It's looking for it not in experiences or particular events. It's the way we've been talking about practice here is we're looking for an unconditioned happiness, a contentment that doesn't come and go. And I think wherever we're at in our practice, to come to a sesshin like this is amazing. We're like, anyone who's here, we're like on the right track. We still might be looking for good experiences in sesshin, really kind of content and blissful experiences. I think that's common because we're sentient beings. But we're getting closer and closer in the silence and stillness of sesshin or zazen practice to discover an unconditioned contentment. So one of my teachers calls it happiness for no reason. We know about happiness for reasons, but what about happiness for no reason? My mind is not at peace. Please help me find a way to find this peace. Well, bring me your mind and I will pacify it. In a way, it's kind of like I, the one giving you this practice. And that's how I will pacify it, and not finding something to grasp is the pacification. So, if we are identified with being as our true nature, as our true self, if we're identified with being this limited body and individual consciousness, there will always be some sense of lack. Even while we're having the tea, there's still be a little bit like, the tea could be a little cooler, hotter, it's just perfect, but it's gonna end soon, this cup of tea. So, and the reason there'll always be some lack is because there's always something outside of us. As long as we're an individual body and individual consciousness in a world of other things and people and consciousnesses, there will always be something other than ourself, which is something to grasp. And therefore, we're always missing something. Just this definition of the sentient being, we're always missing something. We try to fulfill ourselves as much as possible, but if our true nature is this individual body and individual consciousness, we're always missing something. Does that make sense? Just because there's something outside of us. We don't include everything. If we don't include everything, we're missing something there's something that's not us. And therefore, we could call that lack. So there'll always be a sense of lack if this is our identity, and if this individual body and individual consciousness is our identity, there will always be some fear also. Some fear because, again, there is something outside of us that could harm us. It all has to do with this inside, outside. If there's something outside of us, we'll always be lacking something, and we'll always be possibly fearing something. And we're also fearing our own death. If we are this individual body and individual consciousness, in the background, along with all other fears, there's this fear that, like, if this is my identity, I'm going to end. That's the big one, the big fear. So sentient beings always have some lack and some fear, and we try to patch it up and make the best of it. We try to make the best of samsara. But even in our Zen practice, I think, we want a quiet place, and we want to like, a temporarily peaceful weekend. But what about the unconditioned, non-temporary peace that Buddha offers? Sometimes we think, that's too much. It's like, that's too far-reaching. A peaceful weekend sesshin is good enough for me. And it's pretty good. I think so, it's pretty good. But we have this chance too. I mean, I just want to give a plug for the Buddha's possibility of I think that this tradition's founded on the possibility of happiness for no reason, of unconditioned peace. And we don't talk about it that much because it sounds so awesome. But what if our true nature our true identity is not actually this individual body and this individual consciousness. What is it that knows this body and this consciousness? Is there experiencing happening right now? If you're having an experience, then there's experiencing happening. And this experiencing, this awareness, we can start to examine it. And as we did yesterday, we carefully examine while as much as possible being this awareness that we can't grasp, we can't get a hold of, and we can't find. We can examine, does it seem to arise as soon as we settle into it? Or was it like it was already there and we've just kind of noticed it? Can we find any arising, abiding, or ceasing in this awareness, as this awareness? And if we do seem to find any, like, yeah, there's the arising of it. What is it that knows that arising? And does that awareness have any arising? At some point, if we step back, we find there's no arising and ceasing here. And then we can examine, that's the sense of time, the temporal element of awareness, is there's no arising and ceasing in time. And then we can examine the spatial dimension. Does it have any location, this awareness? Does it have any center? Does it have any edges or boundaries? And if we don't find those, then not only is it timeless, but it's dimensionless. Does it seem to exist? No, it's not like these other things that we can find that seem to exist. It's not something to exist. But we don't really say that it doesn't exist either, because it's not nothing. Here we are. This is it. It's this awareness that we're all that is listening to these words, that's feeling a bottom on a cushion, that's seeing a room. This awareness is not nothing. Right? It's filled with sounds and sensations and sights. So if it's really all-inclusive, like we talked about yesterday, if we can't find any edges, there doesn't seem to be anything outside of awareness. And if we do seem to feel that there's something outside it, what is aware of that that feeling of something being outside it? And is that awareness have anything outside it? So we explore more and more and find, if it's truly boundless, with nothing, boundless means there's nothing outside. That's what it means, right? Boundless means there's no boundary, like space. There's nothing outside of space. If we find awarenesses like that, then these two issues of sentient beings, the fear of harm from something outside of ourself, is now quite different, right? The body can still be harmed by things outside itself. And if my identity is my body, then I will fear. But if my true identity, my true nature, is not this body but the awareness, then the relationship to fear is quite different, right? I can't be harmed. The body can be harmed. The consciousness, individual consciousness, can be harmed by nasty thoughts and painful experiences. But the awareness itself can't be harmed, right? So, and also, this issue of lack. It needs to, if I as the body and individual consciousness feel like I need something outside me to fulfill myself, if we kind of shift that identity to I am the space of awareness with nothing outside myself, then by the very definition of myself, there's no lack because there's nothing that's not me, right? There's nothing that's outside myself. Strange. And these, you know, we can have to explore these deeply and experientially and over again and resolve our doubts gradually. And then we can shift back and forth. Like in Zazen, maybe we can actually let our identity, our sense of who we really are, our sense of our true nature. They use this word true nature a lot in Zen. Even self-nature, the sixth ancestor uses over and over. If you can see your self-nature, you can be really free. And we can shift into that mode and be like, maybe for a moment, really feel like, this really does feel like more who I actually am. And in that moment, there's zero lack and there's zero fear. But then we have a strong habit of identifying with its body and consciousness. So we like snap back into it and oh, now there's a bunch of lack and a bunch of fear. Like there's the lack of like, I just lost that amazing freedom. Where did it go? Did it actually cease? If it was something, if that freedom is something that arises and ceases, that's not the one that we're talking about. But I lost touch with it, right? The sun is always shining, but often it's obscured by clouds of dualistic consciousness. Dogen, yes?
Just regarding the tea.
The tea, yeah.
And getting a bowl of tea, and you say there's lack, but a lot of times, you know, when you do ceremonial tea or something, it's like there's the tea, and the amazing bowl, and the calligraphy, and the bouquet, and there's just wonder about it all.
Sometimes in the stillness and tea ceremony like that, or it could be anything, we maybe actually are starting to, without even noticing or intending to, we're starting to fall back into the big space of awareness. Could be that actually, because it's, remember, this awareness is not separate from having tea. It's right there with the tea. And we might start to settle into the spaciousness like that. And then we feel like it's not so much that the tea and the scroll and the flowers are fulfilling, but more like the space is naturally fulfilling, and we fall back into it because of this, of the beautiful setup of the tea. Could be like that.
And there's no question of whether you're content or not content. It's just like that. So
But again, I think it's good to look at this issue of we have lots of contentment through the day, even just having an ordinary cup of tea, but temporary is the key thing, is this a temporary experience? And like I say, that's as sentient beings. That's we're constantly trying to have lots of temporary experiences of contentment and extend them as long as we can, and increase them as much as we can. But that's the job of sentient beings, our inherited work. and then the job of bodhisattvas is we don't stop doing that. I mean, I don't intend to stop doing that myself. But there can also be, at the same time, looking for the happiness for no reason, that will be the same when we leave the ceremony. Not only leave the tea ceremony, but we leave the tea ceremony and somebody comes up to us and just shouts in our face and says, like, I can't believe you were doing a tea ceremony, but you were supposed to meet me. What? And we're like, we want to have the contentment that doesn't change when the experience changes. That one's harder. But I think it's a good point that that it's the awareness that's always content is not something separate from the experiences. Actually, remember, the movie on this is not something someplace different than the screen. So the screen is right there with the person yelling at us, but it's maybe easier to start settling into the screen during a movie of a tea ceremony. So that's why we do things like sesshin and tea ceremonies, because it's hard to find it when somebody's screaming in our face. But as bodhisattvas, we vow to eventually, gradually, open to the supreme peace of someone screaming in our face. Dogen Zenji, in the 13th century, wrote an essay called Mind Cannot Be Grasped, or Ungraspable Mind. And he begins with a quote from our great original teacher in India, Shakyamuni Buddha, from the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Prajna Paramita Vajra Chedaka Sutra. The Diamond Cutter is like, we usually often just say the Diamond Sutra. Vajra Chedaka is like a, the diamond that's indestructible. So it can cut anything, but it itself can't be cut. That's the Prajna Paramita. And in the Sutra, the Buddha says, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. Past mind is pretty obvious because it doesn't exist at all. It's gone. Future mind is pretty obvious, doesn't exist at all. It's gone. And present mind is this one. Also, when we look for it, like the second ancestor, Hueka, we can't find it. So nice to not find something once in a while. So, Dogen says, this has been a point of study by Buddha ancestors. And point of study here is a term Dogen likes to use in many of his essays in Japanese, sankyu. The san is the same as dokusan. We have these meetings. San means meeting, actually. And kyu is like to investigate thoroughly. And I saw it. So sometimes we might think, well, Dogen just says, just sit and just don't think anything. But over and over, Dogen uses this term in the Shobo Genzo essays. We might say thoroughly investigate. It's not clear whether he's saying to do this in Zazen or outside of Zazen, but he definitely promotes thorough investigation, meeting something and thoroughly investigating, and maybe meeting with others like this. But here it's translated as point of study. I would maybe translate it as, this has been the thorough investigation by Buddhas and ancestors. I like translating it as Buddhas and ancestors. The Buddhas are the those who've like gone beyond, and the Zen ancestors are like, somewhere Dogen actually says that ancestors aren't exactly Buddhas, but they're bodhisattvas on the path. This has been a, could say, the thorough investigation by Buddhas and ancestors who have gouged out the caves and baskets from what is ungraspable in the past, present, and future. And the translator put in, for caves and baskets, limited dualistic views, which is a nice hint. There's a lot of this, you know, Zen poetic language. So these parenthetical notes are nice. Another translation that I think is maybe works even better than caves and baskets is pits and cages. Pits and cages. That sounds even more to me like limited dualistic views. So, mind is ungraspable. This has been a thorough investigation by Buddhas and ancestors who have gouged out the pits and cages of limited dualistic views from what is ungraspable in the past, present, and future. Dogen is hard, right, these senses. We can hear from what is ungraspable, this boundless awareness, these Buddhas and ancestors, by thoroughly investigating the boundlessness of awareness, they've gouged out all the pits and cages and traps and dualistic fixation that seems to be in the awareness. They've gouged it out by looking for it and not finding it. For example, something arising and ceasing is kind of a limited dualistic view. It's a subtle one, but the Buddhas and ancestors examine awareness and don't find any arising and ceasing. They don't find that particular pit and cage. So they gouge out the arising and ceasing from what is ungraspable. Pretty cool. It's just amazing that Dogen can speak this way.
And what I'm noticing is Dogen uses this phrase more than once. In the Ango fascicle, gouging out a cave in an empty sky.
He does use it there, yeah.
Is there a similar reference? And what is this gouging out and cave image?
Yeah. I mean, we could hear it in the same way. If we open to it, like, it just means limited dualistic views. I think Dogen says in his Ango fascicle, nice you caught that, which is practice period. He says a practice period is like gouging out a cave in empty space. I think it's what he says, right? So you could say, really, the practice period is just empty space. The practice period is actually boundless awareness. And the Buddhas and ancestors gouge out any ideas of the practice period beginning on a certain day and ending on another day, for example. That is some event that happens in time and space. It looks that way. They do ceremonies to begin and end it. But really, we understand this practice period is timeless. It's beginningless and endless. You could say, that's how they're open to practice period. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So, they have, these Buddhas and ancestors, they have used the caves and baskets of the self to do so. We could say, they've used the pits and cages of themselves to gouge out the pits and cages. Yeah, that's good.
Experience of the self?
Nice, yeah. They used experience. And you could say, these examinations that we're doing, like asking ourselves, can I find any edge or boundary of awareness? It's kind of using dualistic consciousness, right? We're using words and language. These are methods to arrive at non-dual, non-limited boundlessness. In other words, looking for the edge of awareness is an activity of dualistic consciousness, and the result of that is not finding the edge, and that not finding the edge is no longer the dualistic consciousness. So we use dualistic consciousness to arrive at what is not. You could say that's all these discussions are about that too, and all of Dogen's writings. We're using words and language to gouge out the pits and cages of dualistic views from what is ungraspable. And then Dogen goes on. This self is ungraspable mind. Or you could say, we ourselves are ungraspable mind. So that's kind of like what I was mentioning earlier about what is our identity. self can be kind of a loaded word in Buddhism. It could be a whole other discussion in itself. But who we truly are is ungraspable mind. So that's like, you could say, who we truly are is ungraspable mind, our true nature. Thinking and discerning, in other words, dualistic thinking and conceptual discerning at this very moment is ungraspable mind. So that's the other side, you could say. The boundless, non-dual nature of ungraspable mind is ungraspable mind. And then the thinking and discerning and conceptual activity, the true nature of that stuff is also ungraspable mind. The true nature of dualistic consciousness is non-dual awareness. The true nature of everything that appears in the movie is actually the screen. You could say, the movie that we're watching is a movie of thinking and discerning. But that's like, you could say that's the play of this screen. The unchanging screen. Does that make sense? So these two sentences, first it's talking about the kind of the big mind aspect. Our true nature is ungraspable mind, but also small mind, in the second sentence, is also ungraspable mind. At this very moment. The entire body that utilizes the 12 hours of a day is ungraspable mind. I think this entire body is also the kind of Zen talk for like our true, not our physical body, but our like our Dharma body, our boundless body, our. I think it's different Chinese characters, but elsewhere Dogen says. The true human body is a radiant light. So in this case, the entire body, and this is referring, as Dogen often does, referring to all these Chinese Zen stories and phrases. So this comes from the story of a monk coming to Jiaozhou and asking the teacher Jiaozhou during the 12 hours, and you know in Chinese there's 12 hours, but it's 24. It's the we would say 24 hours. So during the 12 or the 24 hours, how should I use my mind? A monk asks Jiaozhou, and Jiaozhou says, "You are used by the 12 hours. I use the 12 hours. What is this time that you're talking about?" Jiaozhou says. So I can say, as a sentient being, we feel as if I am a limited body and an individual consciousness that's kind of like walking around in this this field called time. And I'm being kind of pushed around by it. I am a person that's dwelling in time. And therefore, Jiaozhou says, you as a sentient being are used by the 12 hours. But I, we could understand it as, I, the true nature of Jiaozhou, and your true nature too. But we could say here, this big I, that's the boundlessness of awareness uses the 12 hours. Because instead of a person, an individual person, is some entity within time, and therefore time is impinging itself on us. But boundless awareness includes time within itself. See, we've talked about this some yesterday. Time and space are not something that awareness is happening in. Time and space are happening within awareness. And we can confirm this by these investigations, like, does the awareness arise and cease? No, it doesn't arise and cease. That means it's not in time. But time, the appearance of arising and ceasing, and clocks ticking, all that stuff that's appearing like that, that's happening within awareness, right? So I, as the awareness, I use the 24 hours. But you as a sentient being are used by the 24 hours. Does that make sense? Time is an interesting one to investigate. Time and space, in a way, are like the building blocks for every other experience. So it's kind of going to the root of all experiences, which we're defining here as limited events in time and space, are built of time and space. But their true nature is timeless, spaceless knowing of events.
So they're baskets and caves.
Time and space are baskets and caves, yeah. Yeah, totally. They're quite subtle baskets and caves, but yeah. So using that quote of Jiaozhou, Dogen says, the entire body that uses the 12 hours is ungraspable mind. Ungraspable mind in which time, in which the 12 hours is like playing out. The screen is happy to watch a movie of a clock ticking. And know that that movie is itself, is its timeless self. So Buddhas and ancestors understood mind that's ungraspable from the time they entered the inner chambers of their masters. So enter the chamber is nyushitsu in Japanese. It means like entering the room, literally. And it's a term for Dokusan, actually, in the early Zen records. So I'm good saying that the Buddhas and ancestors understood this through hearing the Dharma from people. It didn't just pop into their zazen magically. There's a transmission of Dharma that's been going on from even before Shakyamuni Buddha, and it can be conveyed through meeting. Right? So it's Dogen saying it didn't just pop into their understanding as some kind of magical grace. It came through many discussions. They understood mind is ungraspable from the time that they entered the room of the teacher. Without entering the inner chambers, they would not have been questioning, answering, seeing, and hearing about ungraspable mind. So through discussions, we can say, try out this questioning and looking and hearing in these ways. And Dogen has an essay called Guidelines for Following the Way. And he says, Zen practice basically just consists of two things. Shikan taza, just wholeheartedly sitting, and san chi mon po, which means it's the same san, meeting or dokusan, or san chi, meeting the teacher and inquiring into Dharma. Nice. Of course, we have that in our tradition. And this is we're having these discussions now. Genzo Ei Sesshin is great for this, I think, because we have a lot of Shikan Taza and we have a lot of Sanshi Monpo. We need to get our conceptual minds really investigating deeply. But if we're just doing that all the time, or we don't just sit and let the conceptual investigations sink into our direct presence of zazen, then it just becomes conceptual musings. So. Yeah, so she is like teacher, like doshi or roshi.
So she, S-H-I, she or
she? S-H-I, okay. She. So san shi is meeting a teacher, and mon is like, sometimes mondo, you might have heard of Zen mondo, is like a question and answer ceremony. So mon is like questioning or inquiring, and po or ho, you... As a compound, you say po, but ho means dharma. So literally, it's meeting teacher, questioning or inquiring into dharma. Yeah, san shi mon po. Yeah, and shi kan taza. He says Dogen says there that those are the two key pieces of Zen practice. And there's other things we can add in like. Orioki and stuff, but these are the key pieces. And I think any spiritual tradition, definitely any Buddhist tradition, has these elements. And Dogen says, this is not even dreamed of by those who are masters of sutras and treatises, or by Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. So just Dogen likes doing these little kind of rants. Maybe it's just like, it's when the Zen school is beginning, and this Dogen's kind of the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, right? There was some Rinzai Zen before him, but Buddhism had been for centuries already in Japan. But Zen was something new, and Zen is the special transmission outside the sutras, right? Pointing directly to mind, realizing true nature, and being Buddha. That's Bodhidharma's kind of classic statement of what Zen is. And so in these early days of Zen, Dogen's, I think, you know, kind of trying to promote his new tradition in a way, and sometimes I think other traditions did this too. It's, I don't know. But sometimes it's a little critical for these other Buddhist schools that aren't about this direct experiential taste, because they're just too into studying the details of the sutras and treatises. That's, I think, what he's talking about. The scholastic Buddhists can't dream of this directly pointing to the ungraspable mind. And Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas is another Mahayana term for the small vehicle practitioners who are into just their own individual liberation, and that aren't bodhisattvas, that are vow to include all beings within their the vastness of their freedom. So when I say that all of us are, all sentient beings are always looking for happiness, this path is not just about our own happiness, of course, right? It's about everybody's happiness and contentment. But I would say, and people, it may sound funny, but I think the way we bodhisattvas can really help others is to find their own contentment. And I haven't heard Thich Nhat Hanh once say something like that. The main job of a Dharma teacher is to be happy. And I think he didn't mean by like getting everything that you want. I think what he meant is to discover more and more the happiness for no reason. Because if we're like, yeah, you know, I'm not really happy, but you should be, and I'll help you be. I mean, sometimes this is maybe like the sort of martyr method or something. But I think bodhisattva path is really like, it's through like how can we help someone find happiness if we don't know how to find it, right? So, but then we can, you know, the Shravakas and Pradeka Buddhas can get so into their own happiness that then they forget that the point of it is for everybody to be happy. And since we're not separate, we all share this one true reality of awareness. In a way, you could say I as an individual can't really be completely happy unless everybody is completely happy. That's the extent of the Bodhisattva's vow. So, here is a familiar example. Or here's an example of ungraspable mind. This is the main story of this essay now. Dushan, it's about Dushan, Tokusan in Japanese, Virtue Mountain, who lived 780 to 865 in the Tang Dynasty. And he was an expert on the Diamond Sutra. And before I read the whole story here, this is another version of the story from Andy Ferguson's book of Chinese ancestors. It's virtually identical, but the beginning is a little more. Dogen leaves off this kind of dramatic sort of beginning of Dushan's mission. So I like this version. Dushan, so again, there's the other schools of Buddhism going on. In China now, we're backing up 4 or 5 centuries from Dogen, going back in China to actually the kind of early days of Zen in China. It had been around for maybe a century, but it was still new enough that it wasn't the dominant thing. It was becoming more like the dominant school of Buddhism in China. But there were more scholastic schools, like we talk about. Dushan, I don't know if he was part of the Tiantai school or what, but he wasn't Zen. He was a Buddhist scholar of the Diamond Sutra, the teachings of emptiness. But not Zen, and he heard about this Zen thing, and this is what he said to himself. When Dushan heard that the southern school of Zen was flourishing, he railed against it, saying, "Those who leave home as monks may study the great meaning of Buddhism for 1,000 eons and spend a further 10,000 eons performing detailed Buddhist practice, yet they still won't become a Buddha." That's the kind of classic Mahayana Buddhism, is it takes eons of practicing on the Bodhisattva path over many, many lifetimes, evolving the stream of consciousness to gouge out the very last caves and baskets and be a completely continuously realized Buddha, right? So that's the kind of classic teaching that Dushan was into. That's how people understood the path to Buddhahood. And so devoted practitioners spend eons studying the great meaning and then practicing it. Yet they still won't become a Buddha. How dare those southern devils say that just by pointing to the human mind, one can see self-nature and become Buddha? That's a quote from Bodhidharma, because he heard they're claiming that. It's the southern school, right, in the south. There wasn't a southern school until Zen came along. It was a long, gradual process. But the southern people were saying, it's kind of a radical statement if you understand this larger context of Buddhism, that just by turning the light around and recognizing your own true nature of mind and its qualities of non-arising, non-ceasing, no location, center, boundaries, all-inclusiveness, inherent peacefulness and fearlessness and no lack, all those are natural qualities of this awareness. That's kind of like Buddha. at the time of recognition, that's like at least one moment of being that awareness is one moment of being Buddha. And the Zen people talk that way too. It's like, you might not never forget it again, but in this moment of direct seeing, that's it. It's no different from the Buddha. But then we forget too. But the southern devils of Zen, you know, they, how dare they make such a claim that you can even meet Buddha for a moment. You would say even a taste of Buddha would take countless eons. So then he says, Dushan says, I'll go and drag them out from their caves and exterminate their ilk and thus repay the kindness of the Buddhas. So Dogen leaves that part off. Dogen just starts, Dushan Xuanjian was proclaiming that he had mastered the Diamond Sutra, calling himself Diamond King Zhao. So Zhao is Dushan's family name. So he was known, he was a renowned Prajnaparamita scholar at this time. And people, also other people called him Diamond King Zhao. He's the king of the Diamond Sutra. He claimed that he was particularly familiar with Xinglong's commentary on the Diamond Sutra. He had collected 12 bundles of commentaries, and he apparently had this big backpack with all the Diamond Sutra commentaries that he carried around. Precious Dharma. And it appeared that he was incomparable. However, he was merely a descendant of Dharma teachers of letters. Words and letters. And his backpack was heavy, full of them. Once, hearing about the unsurpassable Dharma transmitted true air to true air in the south, that's Zen, Dushan felt very competitive. He learned about the assembly of Longtan, Zen master Chongxin, so he crossed mountains and rivers carrying his books to meet him. To go meet the Zen teacher Longtan. On his way, he stopped to catch his breath and saw an old woman. Later, I'll tell you that his meeting with Longtan happens after this. So he's on the road and comes across this old woman. And this is when things get scary. One thing I love about Zen is it has a lot of stories of scary women. A lot of Buddhist traditions don't have stories about scary women. But Zen has a lot. And they're usually very ordinary, so they don't seem scary until the great Buddhist practitioners meet them and they casually show up the cages and baskets of the great Buddhist practitioners. So scary. Like one time near Zhaozhou, the Zen teacher Zhaozhou, near his community there was an old woman selling tea on the road. They're often like selling treats or tea. They're just ordinary people, right? Maybe that's the way to draw in the Zen people, because Zen people like tea and Okashi. They like mochi treats. And they know that, so they're like, this is not going to catch them. So this one woman selling tea or something, and on the way to some holy mountain, like a pilgrimage spot, so all the Zen monks would come by and they'd see her on the road and say, which way to that mountain? Maybe she was at the crossroads. And she'd say, just go straight ahead. And they'd walk off, and then they'd kind of look back, and they're like, was that a kind of a Zen instruction? Or what did she, am I just like, and then they realize, like, what does straight ahead mean, you know? So this happened over and over again. And at some point, one of those practitioners, Jiaozhou, lived nearby. So he was a Zen teacher. So they reported this old woman and said, every time somebody Zen person comes by, she just says, go straight ahead. And Jiaozhou says, okay, just don't worry about it. Like, I'll go check her out for you, okay? You know this story? And so Jiaozhou goes up there and goes, which way to that mountain? And she says, just go straight ahead. And Jiaozhou says, okay, and goes on. And then he comes back to the assembly and to give a talk, and he says to them, today I went and checked out that woman for you. He knows how to use the 24 hours. There's another one, I don't know how old she was, but another scary story about a Zen woman is, I think she was a nun, actually, not a tea seller. There was this Zen hermit, Judy, who later became famous for answering every question by holding up a finger. Anyone ask any Dharma question, like, what is this boundless awareness? It's pretty good. And it's also pretty good to answer every question like this. Later, after he had some understanding, he could answer like that. But at this time, he was just practicing in the mountains as a hermit. And one time in the evening, the Zen nun with her big traveling hat, you know, these big bamboo hats, she like bursts into his hermitage while he's meditating. And she walks around him three times and says, if you can say something, I'll take off my hat. And Judy was like speechless. I mean, what could he say? He was freaked out. Right? He was like, say, give me some word of Zen here. He couldn't say anything. And then she's like, okay, well, I'll be going now. And she starts to walk out the door, and Judy gets up and says, it's getting really late, and it's a long way from anywhere else. Why don't you stay the night? We don't know about the kind of risque quality of these old Zen stories, right? And she says, if you can say something, I'll stay the night. He couldn't say anything, so she left. And that's when he realized, I really got to practice. Because Zen, as we'll see in this story, is, you could say it's a third quality of Zen, besides just sitting and inquiring about the Dharma. You could say that maybe following that, there's the Zen practice of expressing yourself completely. Zen is maybe more than other Buddhist traditions, is a lot about like direct expression, especially Rinzai Zen and the koan tradition. If you're working on a koan, you don't give a kind of conceptual answer. You give a direct expression, a spontaneous direct expression of your understanding of the koan. So here's another scary Zen woman story. Dushan's heading south to meet Longtan and refute that sudden school teacher. But on the way, he meets this old woman whose character means kind of like grandmother. And he says, what do you do? Or who are you? And she says, I sell rice cakes. In this case, it's the mochi. Maybe sweet bean cakes. And Dushan says, well, please sell me some. And she says, what will you do with them, Reverend? Dushan says, I will eat them to refresh myself. He can speak a little bit. So now is there's a key thing here that this is where it's hard to to translate into English because there's a word play going on. This is a great Zen word play thing, and it's hard to get it in English because y'all know dim sum? Anyone not know dim sum? Dim sum are like rice cakes that can be vegetable or sweet. It's like a rice paste dumpling, right? And they go way back to the Tang Dynasty, at least. So dim sum is, I'm not sure what kind of dialect this is, but in Mandarin it's tianxin, yeah. Or in Japanese, tenjin. And tian, or ten, or dim, means, literally can mean like to dot, or to refresh, or to touch, or to satisfy, or to spark. You know that character? So, dot, touch, spark, but also refresh, satisfy. And xin is the same xin we talked about for a whole day yesterday, mind or heart, right? So, tian xin or dim sum. Do you know anything about about that dialect of dim sum? Oh, you do? Yeah, also. But also dim sum?
Yeah, dim sum is Cantonese.
Cantonese. Yeah. So Cantonese and Mandarin.
Yeah,
Mandarin pronunciation.
Dim sum versus dim sum.
Okay.
Southern, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think in America they almost always call it dim sum.
Yeah. Well, it's because the Cantonese have this whole dim sum culture.
Oh, okay.
So they've brought it over.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah. Uh-huh. So it literally means to, like, to touch the heart, or to refresh the mind. I think that's the. I think for our case here, this would be the best translation. To satisfy is how this translator uses it. I think it's nice to say refresh the mind. They're mind refreshers. They're just little snacks. It's not like a whole meal. It's just a little mind refresher on the road. On a long hot hike to the south. So if we now let's translate dim sum as mind refreshers. So that's if we understand that was just how these cakes were known in those days, and in these days, then she this woman is going to play with this. Do a word play, right, with this meaning of dim sum. So what will you do with them? Dushan says, I will eat them to refresh my mind. I will eat the mind refreshers to refresh my mind. And the old woman says, what are you carrying there on your back? And Dushan said, haven't you heard of me? I am Diamond King Zhao. I specialize in the Diamond Sutra. There's no part of it I haven't mastered or understood. These are important commentaries on the sutra. And the old woman says, may I ask you a question? And Dushan says, of course, ask me anything. The old woman said, I was told, because, you know, I don't read sutras and stuff, but I was told that the Diamond Sutra says, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. Which mind will you refresh with these mind refreshers? Which sum will you dim with these dim sum? Right? If you can answer, I will give you some cakes. Otherwise, I will not. And again, like if you can say something, it's this word in Japanese. Answer is here dotoku, and Dogen has a whole fascicle called Dotoku, that's often translated as expression. And in that essay of Dogen, he's talking about how important it is for Zen people to be able to express something like directly and spontaneously and clearly in a dynamic situation, which is hard to do. So so that's what she's really saying is, if you can say something, if you can directly express something, I'll give you some cakes. Otherwise, I won't. So she's one of these scary women, right? Which mind will you refresh with these mind refreshers? Past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. Which of these minds will you refresh with these mind refreshers? That's a great question, I think. You can sit with this question. She was sharp to ask this, I think. It's a fun wordplay, but it's also a kind of profound question. Because we do want to satisfy our mind. But which mind is satisfied? By eating a rice cake, right? We're talking about something very ordinary, mundane activity of refreshing the mind by just eating a rice cake. What is actually refreshed there? And as often is the case, you could say there's a play going on here with these two truths. In Zen stories often have this dynamic interplay between the so-called ultimate truth. This weekend we're saying ultimate truth provisionally. It's a dangerous term, we know. But saying the ultimate is that which, something that can't be... actually, one nice definition of ultimate truth in the kind of middle way teachings, I think they sometimes define it as that which can withstand reasoning. Interesting sort of philosophical definition. Whereas conventional truth cannot withstand reasoning. In other words, like if you start to examine what some conventional thing is and you start to really look into it, and say, well, does it exist on its own? No, it only is here dependent on other things. And if we start to reason about it, the thing can't withstand that reasoning, and it disintegrates, or it's deconstructed into emptiness by reasoning about it. But ultimate truth isn't deconstructed by reasoning about it. That's one way strange way to look at ultimate truth. But also, we could just say, that which I think by ultimate truth, we say something, a realm that doesn't come and go, and a realm that that isn't destroyed and can't be harmed by anything. And also, like all-inclusive. These types of definitions kind of go with this lofty term, ultimate truth. And conventional truth is like... the things that come and go and are impermanent and unreliable. So in the TV screen and the movie metaphor, you could say the screen is like unchanging, and of course TV screens are indestructible, but awareness is not like something that can be destroyed. If it could be destroyed, it would be some conditioned impermanent entity. It's not an entity that could be either born or die. So the screen is like that, and the movie is like the conventional truth of birth and death. Inseparable. The two truths are inseparable and cannot be divided, like our gassho. And so we could say this question is kind of like one way to look at what's the integration of these two truths? Past, present, and future mind are ungraspable. It's like the ultimate truth. But who's going to enjoy these mind refreshers. You know, what kind of mind is going to be refreshed by these cakes? But see how that's kind of like a... what's the ultimate truth got to do with like enjoying a rice cake? And what's the eating the rice cake got to do with ungraspable mind? So, dumbfounded, Dushan was unable to answer or unable to express. So, dotoku means expression, right? So this is dofutoku. He's not able to express. The old woman flapped her sleeves and went away without giving Dushan any rice cakes. I guess Zen has this sleeve flapping thing. Maybe they had baggy sleeves. Like, walked away. And then Dogen says, "How regrettable. The king of commentators who wrote commentaries on hundreds of scrolls, a lecturer for decades, was so easily defeated by a humble old woman with a single question. There's great difference between those who have entered the authentic teacher's inner chamber and received transmission and those who have not." Dushan said to himself, "A painted rice cake does not satisfy hunger." He's now known as a Dharma heir of Longtan, so you kind of know what's going to happen later. This teacher he's going to refute, he becomes his disciple. But I think another translation for this section here is that I think is kind of nice is, only after inheriting Dharma from Longtan could he say that a painted rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. I like that one. Because right now he still thinks that the pile of sutras on his back can satisfy hunger, but actually it's actually just a heavy burden. That's what this phrase, a painted rice cake, doesn't satisfy hunger. One of our Genzoe Sashins, we did at Jikoji a few years ago, was on another essay of Dogen called Gabyo, which means painted rice cake. And it's all exploring this term, painted rice cake doesn't satisfy hunger. And if you haven't heard this, it's referring to verbal teachings and written teachings about the ultimate truth and so on don't really satisfy our hunger for peace. They're paintings of all these words that we're talking and all these writings that we're reading of Dogen are paintings of rice cakes. But we want to eat an actual rice cake, right? The words, somewhat they satisfy our hunger, right? But they start to, and I think they're necessary. I really think they're super helpful. But as I said yesterday, we can have the understanding from the concepts is like a essential ingredient, but it's like a patch. This is the Tibetan Dzogchen tradition uses these images. The conceptual understanding is good, but it's like a patch, like a sewn-on patch or a puttied patch, and it'll eventually fall off. We need direct experience of what has been conceptually understood. So a taste of actually take a bite of the rice cake, but then it said that experience is like the mist. It's just a temporary event in time and space, and it fades. So then, based on the conceptual understanding, and then we can have a direct experience. Based on the direct experience, we can then start to extend it and work on maintenance and bring it into our, not just our zazen, but our daily life and tea ceremonies and eating rice cakes and all kinds of things. And until there's continuity. And then that's called realization. And that, space, which doesn't fall off and doesn't fade. Well, this continuity is like a big one. This is the gradual part of Zen. You could say that the second one, the experience, is maybe what's celebrated in Zen. It's like in the sudden school, you can have a, because experience always happens suddenly. It always happens in a particular moment. You can really kind of get something. You can really come to see that awareness is present, and the only thing that knows that it's present is awareness itself. And when we look for any boundaries or location, we can't find it. And we look for it arising and ceasing, we can't find it. All these things can be like experientially confirmed in a moment, but then after zazen, we forget about it. So we can confirm over and over and extend, and that's the long, slow, gradual process. But one of my Tibetan teachers says, I remember one time somebody asked, and in a kind of, because it's all about this non-dual awareness also, and somebody asked, sometimes I feel like we're getting so nitpicky about all these details, and we're trying to work it out, and feels like we're really trying to find this stability in the unfindable awareness. And what about the spirit of just like just letting it all be and just relaxing here, and because isn't this all it? And why all this effort? And I think it's a good point, because we can make too much effort. But he said something like, well, if you're in the recognition of your true nature as awareness, and kind of like as your true nature, like that's you're identifying with that more than your individual body and mind, like all the time without break, then you don't need to do any particular practice. So it's, we talk about no gaining idea, but sometimes we think, well, it's all it. But I feel like if I'm honest with myself, I'm like, no, I'm not. There's definitely not continuity in this, and then I think another trap is like, but I don't think it's really possible to have this continuity like this. That's another one, and so I think that's why that second aspect of understanding experience and realization, you have the direct experience, even for a moment. The nice thing about that, even though it's impermanent, is it's like a confirmation. It's like, oh no, this is really how it is. And if a thousand scholars came and tried to refute me with some good logic or something, I wouldn't care, because I like had a bite of rice cake and it satisfied my hunger temporarily. And now I know it's possible, what truly is possible, and I know that it's very rare, and I'm not there most of the time. So then we can have a lot of motivation to practice. Yeah.
Just a comment. I mean, mm-hmm. All these parables always have a woman poking a pin into a male ego, right?
Yeah.
She seems to be invariable. And
she's a sharp pin to pop an arrogant ego, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But then they poke a pin into her.
Yes.
Why do they? I mean, and then that brings up the whole question. I'm relatively new to this, but it seems to be like the Buddha and all the ancestors. Where are all the women? I mean,
there are women ancestors. Remember the woman who said, "I'll take off my hat." Her name is Shirji. I don't know if it's Jokoji. Do you ever chant the women ancestor lineage?
We have them occasionally.
So it's kind of a more modern thing to gather the list of all the great Zen women adepts, and Shirji from that story is one of them. But you're right. I think there's a lot of cultural factors, right? There were maybe, especially in the early days, less women Zen practitioners in Asia. Now there's could be more. I've heard that in Taiwan, there's more ordained women Buddhist practitioners than men. I don't know if millions, but thousands. But also political conditions are such that, like, the men are into writing it all down and they have bigger egos, maybe. That's why I think the women show, in a way, this true spirit of Zen, of, like, humility, and they can just be a cake seller and you know, really understand the Dharma.
Yeah. You can't eat those words. You can carry all you want, but you can't eat these words.
Yeah. So now, luckily, in America, we have a new thing where there's as many women Zen teachers as there are men. Probably, it's probably half and half now, and equal. There's no hierarchy in that way. So that's one great gift, I think, of American Buddhism. Yeah, but you're right that Dogen will critique her as this goes on, because Dogen just critiques everyone. I don't think it's because she's a woman. He wants to, and it's a way to bring out more dimensions of this conversation. And he does it in an interesting way, but like, he critiques both of them and says, each one of them could have said this and that, which is a little unusual for Dogen to do this. He sometimes, I mean, maybe does it other places, but here he's like giving all these alternative answers, which I think is kind of fun, what he does here. But we'll save that for this afternoon. But you could take that as like a koan as a question of what would be the simple version would be like. You could simplify it to be just like, mind is ungraspable. So what mind enjoys lunch? You could say it like that. Right?
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.